This morning we'd like to take out Bokoan number 84 from the Hekigon Rokkwu, Uema's Gate of Non-Duality. And the introduction reads, though you say it is, there is nothing that it is can affirm. Though you say it is not, there is nothing that is not can negate. When is and is not are gone beyond, success and failure, winning and losing, are no more. All is open and unobstructed. Now I want to ask you, what is in front of and what is behind me? Some monk might come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Tell me, is that one open-eyed? If you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthy. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, each of us has had his say, now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? And then Secho, who can never keep his mouth shut, says, what did Vimalakirti say? And again he says, I have seen through him. The verse, foolish Vimalakirti, sorrowful for sentient beings, you lie sick in Vayali, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes, the room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate of the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manjushri's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. This comes, of course, from the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is truly a fine sutra. Most of the Buddhist sutras are jawbreakers, to say the least, and do ramble awfully. But the Prajnaparamita Hridaya, the Diamond Sutra, and the Vimalakirti Sutra are exceptions. And this person does recommend that if you are inclined to read sutras, that you do read the Vimalakirti Sutra. We have often thought that we'd like to sort of bring it up to date, write it in the vernacular such that people would really appreciate this marvellous, really marvellous sutra. Oh, there is one other, the Lotus Sutra, which is a bit out of the, what shall I say, tradition of Zen, but that also is a very fine sutra. And it concerns, as you know, Vimalakirti, and what is remarkable about Vimalakirti is that although he was very much a person of the world, he was very successful in business, I believe, nevertheless, he was highly adept in Zen practice. And one part of the story that's in the sutra is how every disciple of Buddha shies away from the prospect of going to visit him on his sickbed because Vimalakirti seems to be able to deflate them so often. So let us get into the introduction. We'll comment on that, and then we'll have something a little bit more to say about some of the characters in the sutra. And it starts off, though you say it is, there is nothing that it is can affirm. Though you say it is. There is nothing it is can affirm. Though you say it is not, there is nothing that it is not can negate. So it is not true to say, I am, and it's not true to say, I am not. It's not true to say the world is there, and it's not true to say the world is not there. In other words, all affirmations are provisional, and they all depend on a point of view, just in the same way that all negations are provisional. And it is this seeing into this truth that is one of the major undertakings that we have when we're practicing. We tend to believe that the world is as we see it. We say it is, that is it. And then we're astonished to find that people see things quite differently to us. And we then assume that, well, they're mistaken, or they don't understand, or they're just being damn difficult, or they're just stupid. The idea that people can see the world radically different to the way we see it is something that we find intolerable. And we see this at the moment with the Muslim Western conflict that's going on. We tend to say, well, the Islamic people are locked back in the 10th century. They are out of date. They are backward and so on. Because really the proper way to see the world is the way that we Westerners see it. And anybody that doesn't see it in that way, as we've just said, is mistaken. And in the case of the Muslims, they're backward. The idea that there is a perfectly consistent and complete way of seeing the world from an Islamic viewpoint, we find unacceptable. Actually, a very good way of working and meditating is to take up some of the Sufi writings. There are many of them now. There's one particular, of course, Ibn Arabi. No, I can't remember what the name is now. Names go out of my mind quicker.
Huh? Ibn Arabi.
Yeah, that's the one. Thank you. But anyway, he's very good. But you'll find that there is a tremendous source of richness and beauty and certainly devotion and love in the Sufi tradition. And the Sufi tradition is, of course, a direct offshoot from the Islamic tradition. But it is this, what I know to be the case is the case. This is sort of basic to the way that we see the world, that it is fixed, that is it. And this, you see this again in a lot of the attitude that people have in science and so on. I think it was in To Know Yourself, we talked about when we were young, and we used to go to the local church hall where they used to show films, and it was one of these things that clackered away, one of these projectors that clackered away and very often broke down. And the film was projected on somebody's sheet that would be hung up in the hall. And when we used to see this, we used to see these old cowboy films. And the old cowboy films, as you know, were all done in the studio. and the you'd see the sheriff coming down the street, about to sort of outgun the lawyer, the outlaw. Lawyer, goodness me. That was a Freudian slip, if you remember. Anyway, the outlaw, and you always knew who the sheriff was because he had a white hat and a white horse, and the outlaw had a black hat and a black horse, so you never were in any doubt. And on the back there of the long street and going through this town, there was the vast vista of desert with cactus and mountains and spreading out in the distance. And you get very tense because this is going to be the climax of the whole thing. This is going to be the showdown. At last, the outlaw is going to get his deserts. He's going to be gunned down by this gallant hero, the sheriff. And then, just as about the sheriff is about to pull his gun out and shoot him, the mountains move. The background is painted. But it's a very interesting thing because once the mountains moved, you could get up and leave this film because everything was spoiled. All the tension was gone, all the drama and everything was gone out of the thing. And why we say this is because we must let the mountains move. This background that we have, which is so solid and firm that we know is the case, is the problem. And this is what it says, when you assert that it is, there is nothing that it is can affirm. That this is a perspective that we have, a point of view. It is very much like the projection of a film onto a screen. Very much, there's a great similarity. And once we can see this, once we can call into question the very basis of our world, it means that we are freed from this rigid prison in which we have found ourselves. And the two ways, most the fruitful ways of working on this, is to see, first of all, into this fundamental belief that I am something. This affirmation, I am something. And then to see equally, and actually once you see into that, you will see into at the same time this the illusory notion that the world is independent, is real, apart from my perspective. And it is that freeing up in that way, that loosening up the very foundation, which is what we call Kensho. It's true that even then there's a tremendous amount of work to be done, but then you're working in the light. You now know what that everything is, what it's about, and you're no longer working with that kind of frustrating, irritating quality that comes until that is there until the mountains have moved. He says, "When is and is not are gone beyond." Success and failure, winning and losing are no more. This means that winning in an absolute way, or success as an absolute state, or failure as an absolute state, are no more. I emphasize that because people are concerned when they hear this kind of thing, success and failure, winning and losing are no more, that life will be one long stretch of boredom. But on the contrary, one can enter into projects, one can get involved in things, one can undertake work in a completely new way, that it's more the process of doing things, the creativity involved, which is the attraction, not the result that comes out of it. Whether the result is accepted or not really is relatively unimportant. I'm not saying it's unimportant, I'm not saying that you can dismiss it, but the real joy is in the creative process. It is in doing that the real joy of existence then is found, rather than exclusively, will I get acknowledged for this or won't I? Am I winning or am I losing? Is my life a success or is my life a failure? It's funny that people actually want to sum up their life in terms of success and failure. My life has been a failure, people sometimes say. But like everything, it's a mixture. It's a mixture of success and failure, winning and losing. It's good and bad. We're very, very complex beings, and to try to sum it up and try to say it is this or that, again, comes out of this need to have an absolute state. That is how it is. That is it. And he says, all is open and unobstructed. In other words, instead of having a world of things that are sort of jostling and banging against one another, one sees the world more and more in terms of a flow, in terms of movement, change, development, progress, and also decrease. And then he says, now I want to ask you, what is in front and what is behind me? This is a very interesting question. What is in front of me? And now, what is that me that is going to determine? If it's the body, then the altar is in front and there's a door behind. But what about me? It's like the question, where are you from? If I say, well, that is the case, then I have fixed the world in terms of absolutes. There is an absolute orientation. But what is in front of me might be behind someone else. And this brings out quite clearly what we mean by the world is a viewpoint, or it comes out of a point of view. We mustn't ever get into the sort of attitude that the world is only a viewpoint, is only a point of view. If we do that, then it suggests that there is another superior way of seeing the world. And it was precisely this that we were tackling in an earlier Tay show. There is no superior way of seeing the world. This is just another claim on an absolute. By seeing this, we can then see that the world is a creation, and we can also see at the same time that we are both one and a multitude. I am myself, but in being myself, I am you as well. Or put this in another way, selfhood includes otherness. Normally we think otherness is an exclusion. That means to say the not-self. But the self and the not-self are one. They're not the same. Because this is a thing that people struggle with when they hear the expression, the world is one. They think that this means to say that the world is just one homogeneous condition, all the same, everything is the same. But it's like a diamond is one, and a diamond gets its beauty from its multifaceted character. And it's exactly the same way with this unity which is the world. It is a sparkling diamond. That wonderful image of Indra's net comes to mind. Before we go on to the case, let us have a look at some of the comments that some of the people said. Vilma Lakirti himself said, Noble sir, flowers like the lotus, the water lily, and the moon lily do not grow on dry ground in the desert. They grow in the swamps and in the mud. In the same way, the Buddha qualities do not grow in living beings who are already awakened, but in those living beings who are like swamps and mud of negative emotions. This is a lovely passage, really. This is going right to the heart of the matter. When we're struggling with ourselves and we just get this, well, this deadness, this dryness, or when we see the things that we've done, the mess we have made of various aspects, the antagonisms we have made, the pain that we have generated, and we see this and it can become quite stark as we sit. We can't help wondering, well, what hope is there for me? I mean, surely these saints and Zen masters and so on must have started on some higher ground than the one that I've occupied in my life. But, and this is the whole point, it is just as he says, that it is out of the confusion that the possibility of a true spiritual life can emerge. Without that, there is no spiritual life. It is in that clash and clang of contradiction that brings about so much inner pain that there is a possibility for some new kind of life to emerge, the kind of life which blossoms in what is often symbolically looked upon as the lotus. It is quite natural for us to become discouraged when we practice, because the discouragement comes from the belief that we are inadequate, that we can't cope, that we can't make the grade. And actually this is very good, because this is quite true. This is how it is. We are inadequate. And it is only when we can actually live with that inadequacy, be completely open to it, that we can then transcend it. You see, as long as we believe in our adequacy, as long as we're comfortable with ourselves and the way that we can operate, as long as we've got that inner security that, after all, we are perhaps not completely in control, but sufficiently in control to get by any kind of circumstance that life can throw up, why would we ever want to work on ourselves? It is precisely because we have run up against it, because this sense of I am the controller, I am the one in charge, is precisely because that one has come up against a brick wall and has been smashed back in the process. We often say that Zen is for the disappointed, for people who have finally recognized that, no, I just can't do it. We've often cited people who have written in to me, or people who have actually spoken to in Doc Sun, who have been through a very difficult, very profoundly upsetting time in their lives. And yet, suddenly out of it all, some shaft of light has shone through. They've had some kind of awakening, even in the midst of their misery. We've written that article on Father Sizek, the Catholic priest who was tormented by the Russians in a terrible way, who finally just gave up. He just gave up God, he gave up prayer, he gave up all hope. He was just reduced down to a state of utter misery. And out of that, he had this revelation, this awakening, call it what you will. The pain that we suffer in a sesshin, this not only the physical pain, although that true too, but this emotional pain of inadequacy, the sense that whatever we do somehow is futile, is essential. I know that from a psychological point of view, the psychologists would say this is not the case, that you have to build up the person's sense of competence, you have to build up a person's self-esteem, you have to do this, that, and the other. And for some people, this is indeed the case. This does, in fact, have to be done. And the psychologists are the people that are competent to do this. But people come regularly to a sesshin, have got sufficient backbone, have got sufficient resilience in them that they do not need psychological help. People who come to a sesshin have got already awakened at some degree or another a clear perception of the truth. And just in the same way that we've said that an awakened person does not know they're awakened, so we do not know that we know the truth. I know that sounds strange, but you see, we're so absorbed and we're so taken up with the conscious mind. We give the conscious mind so much prestige and status that we believe that anything that does not enter into the conscious mind, and it can only do that as a form of some kind or another, anything that does not enter into the conscious mind is unreal. And yet, as we have said so often, that reality is outside. It supports the conscious mind, but it is not the conscious mind. And this reality, this knowing the truth of which I speak, is beyond the conscious mind. It's beyond that kind of knowing that we give so much adherence to. And so, in other words, this sense of failure is always experienced against this background of the truth. And this is why, in spite of the fact that people who come to sesshin constantly encounter this kind of failure, nevertheless, they look forward to the next session. And they don't understand themselves why they look forward to the next session. This person, when we were under training, used to be terrified of the session. We used to get all kinds of aches and pains. We used to sort of walk around cross-eyed two or three days before our session, out of tension. And if anybody, that was the last thing we wanted to do, was to go to session, and yet we couldn't help it. We had to go. In other words, there was a knowing there. And we say, keep on saying to people, have faith in this. This is you. This you're not here because of the personality wants it. The personality is going to grumble. It's going to be miserable. It's going to be upset. It's going to be frustrated. It's going to be all of that. Because it doesn't matter about that personality. There is something much more powerful, much more wonderful that is asserting itself. And if that weren't there, you wouldn't be here. You just wouldn't be here. This is a tremendous self-winnowing process, this centre. We don't sell anything. We don't encourage you. We don't give you any real hope. And yet you come. He says, in a similar way, a seed does not grow in the sky, but on the earth. So the Buddha qualities do not grow in those who are already saints, but in those who seek awakening after having built a mountain of egoistic views as high as Mount Everest. You see, what always is wonderful to this person is that there are people 2,000 years ago struggling with the same kind of concerns as this person struggles with. And they're doing it in just the same way that this person wants to struggle as well. The same question goes through our minds, surely. Oh, look, I've got all of this. I'm just a walking ego. What chance is there? You know, this sense of supreme unworthiness that sometimes one feels afflicted by. And there it is, it says that. This is a lovely, lovely passage. In a similar way, a seed does not grow in the sky, but on the earth. So Buddha qualities do not grow in those who are already saints, but those who seek awakening after having built a mountain of egoistic views as high as Mount Everest. You see, there are ways, particularly in the so-called New Age, where people vault straight into sainthood. They pretend that they've already got into this state, this high state, and they are able to take on an impartial view. They are above all of the strife and concerns and so on. And this has permeated our society because we believe that this is what is required, that if a person has practiced Zen for a couple of weeks or perhaps a month or two, they should already be walking on water. And certainly anybody that's practiced for 10 or 20 years, if he gets angry, I don't understand it. I thought this Zen doesn't, to me, measure up at all. He says, By the same token, one can understand that the family of the Tathagatas includes all our passions. For example, sir, without going out into the great ocean, it is impossible to find precious, priceless pearls. Likewise, without going into this ocean of passions, one cannot reach the mind of pure knowing. And these passions include this, that is one of the passions, that sense of the inner groan is one of the passions. Then there's another one in which Sariputra tells how one should meditate. He says you should absorb yourself in contemplation in such a way that you engage in all ordinary behavior without losing awareness. One must practice. In other words, our practice is not, as you know so well, simply on the mat, but in all ordinary behavior. And this is so important that one should make this determination that you are going to wake up periodically during the day. And you have to make this, you have to be resolute in this. And we often say that one of the ways of doing this is when you chant the four vows in the morning, I hope you do that when you're practicing at home, and you don't have to chant them out loud, but when you're chanting the four vows, there is implicit in that a fifth vow, and that is that you're going to be present, you're going to be aware during the day. And struggle with this. Use various subterfuges, like we suggested, wearing an elastic band or wearing a watch on the other wrist, or various ways that let the telephone ring, an extra ring. But make up your mind, be determined, struggle with this with all of your heart to be present. And above all, when you're with other people, try to be present to those people, just in the same way that you are present to your practice when you're on the mat. Be open to people. Be there for them. This is not only for their sake, because, as we've just said earlier, that other people, the otherness, the you, is part of my world. Or me and you are inhabit exactly the same world in that way. That you and me are not separate. We are not the same. But we're not separate. And he said, in such a way that you can manifest the nature of an ordinary person without losing your cultivated nature. In other words, one is oneself. One is what one is. And when one is what one is an ordinary person. It's only in our imagination that we get exalted, or we exalt other people, because when we've exalted those other people and we know those other people, then that exalts us sort of in a complementary way. We elevate ourselves by elevating other people sometimes. Although, of course, most often we elevate ourselves by putting everybody else down. He says, in such a way that the mind neither settles within nor moves without toward external forms. This is when one keeps the mind free. And this is when we are asking the question, who am I? One of the things that should present itself to us are those things that we are identified with. What am I? And then what is it that we really think that we are? What sort of person do we really believe that we are? Really get to know what sort of person you think you are. It's not that you have an image. People say that you have a self-image, but to this person, no. You have a self-idea. You have a sense of self, which is given focus by a self-idea, the idea of what you are in the world, how other people would see you in the world, or how you want other people to see you, perhaps would be better. But as long as we're fixated on bringing that into the world, showing other people that this is what I am, this is what I stand for, this is the thing that gives me meaning, As long as we're constantly working at that, we have no time for other people. And in fact, we have no time for life, because we're so bound up in this imaginary image or imaginary idea that we have of ourselves that we have nothing left over for reality itself. And in such a way that you can follow all ways without becoming attached to any. In such a way that you are released in liberation without abandoning the passions that are the province of the world. It comes back to that again. You see, one of the things that was also interesting about Vimalakirti is that he is a layperson. And this is very, very important. The fact that there is Vimalakirti Sutra, that Layman Pang play such a dominant part, and that also, of course, you've got the Platform Sutra with Huineng, who is virtually looked upon virtually as the founder of the Zen tradition. In other words, when it says that you are released in liberation without abandoning the passions that are the province of the world, this is exemplified by the fact that lay people can practice Zen as well as, and in my opinion nowadays, much better than people who are in some kind of monastery or Zen center. So let us then take a look at the koan. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, "What is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only?" So first of all, we have to ask ourselves, what is this one and only? We have to be very careful, because this notion of oneness can lead us astray. In fact, in Buddhism, the one is empty. This is the empty. One is empty. No boundaries. And having no boundaries, it has no form. And having no form, it is empty. But on the other hand, it is important for us to retain the notion of oneness, because it is in opposition and conflict, obviously, that suffering arises. But paradoxically, conflict can only arise because of oneness. If there were no oneness that was holding the two together, there could be no conflict. It's like a boxing match. The only thing that makes a boxing match into a match is the oneness of the winner. Both the boxers want to be the one. And in wanting to be the one, they want to destroy the other one who is claiming to be the one. So in other words, it is because we are one, because we are whole, that we suffer. This oneness as well is not an empty box. It's not something that you just put everything into, or what remains after you stripped everything else away. This one is life itself. It is dynamic. It is creative. But it is always dynamic towards unity. It's creative towards re-establishing unity. This drive for unity is the fundamental drive of life. It's going from oneness, through oneness, to oneness. And sometimes if you are practicing, you can really get the feeling for the longing for unity. The longing for love, for example, the longing for love, is just that. Love and oneness are two ways of describing the same thing. This longing for unity, and it's the same with truth. Truth is that sort of inner coherence of everything. The inner coming together of everything, the inner search for unity of everything, and goodness and so on. All of these virtues have as their essence this dynamic thrust towards unity. And as you're sitting, this thrust that there is in you, this longing, this need to practice, this need for something, the need to go beyond, all comes out of the fact that you essentially are dynamic. You are essentially this unity, driving towards unity. You are not some static, empty ghost that sits in passivity. And so the question is, what is the Bodhisattva's gate? In other words, how can we become one with one? How can we become home to ourselves? And Manjushri answered, "To my mind, in all, there are no words, no teaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness." It's interesting. You see, Manjushri, as you know, was the teacher of the seven Buddhas. In other words, you know, Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. It's Prajna, the Manjushri that sits on the lion, on the altar, is wielding the sword of Prajna. And Prajna is the awakened mind. It is the mind which cuts through, it doesn't cut into one or two, it cuts into one. In other words, it cuts through all duality in order to find the unity beyond. And Manjushri, therefore, is the teacher of all Buddhas. It's like a master said, the gate of all wisdom is Prajna. The gate to all mysteries, actually, I'm sorry. The gate to all mysteries is Prajna. It's the aroused mind. It's the mind which is aroused without being attached, without being directed or focused or concentrated or identified with anything. And so therefore, Manjushri is saying there are no words, no teaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. In other words, what he's saying is that getting beyond concepts and words is the key. And we've invited you before, we invite you again to ask yourself, why are words so inhibitive of freedom? Why is Zen constantly exhorting us to go beyond words? And what does it mean to go beyond words? But Manjushri says there are no words. Not only do we go beyond words, he says there are no words. Words themselves are empty. You see, it is in the creation of words that we have words. It's like we talk about the fairy in the corner. How do you get the fairy that's in the corner out of the corner? In other words, we put the fairy there in order to get the fairy out. And once you've done that, you can never get the fairy out. And it's the same with words. That when we start tackling words, we end up using words to tackle them. What we have to do is we have to see beyond that there are no words. But we have to understand that as well very clearly, because it says right at the beginning, though you say it is not, there is nothing there it is not can negate. It is very important for us to realize that we're not getting rid of anything. We're not getting rid of words. We're not getting rid of concepts. We're not getting rid of ideas. Once we start getting rid of these, actually getting beyond them, although one often uses this expression, it is a poor expression. Because once we're getting beyond the words, once we're getting beyond the mind, once we're getting beyond all of this, we're affirming the illusion. We're setting up the problem by trying to get beyond it. And this is why we say there is nothing that needs to be done. As long as you set up in your mind the idea that you have to get through all kinds of situations or get beyond situations, then you've set up barriers that you're going to have to get over, and it's going to take you a lifetime to do it, because every barrier you get over creates a new one. You are already home and complete. Start from there. Already there are no obstructing words. Start from there. And so therefore it's quite a profound statement, although paradoxically it is a very wordy one. To my mind, in all there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. No activity, there is no activity of consciousness. This, of course, is coming back again to the Prajnaparamita. That this constant negation, there is no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no colour, sound, smell, taste, touch, or what the mind takes hold of. In other words, as long as we feel that there is this, that we have to get beyond, then we're stuck with it. We're stuck with a fairy in the corner. And this is the great breakthrough of the Prajnaparamita school, that with the Theravada tradition, of course, with the Abhidharma, there was all of this analysis of the mind, breaking up the mind into eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. All of that analysis was done, and as a consequence, one was left with a whole series of traps and obstacles in any kind of practice that one has. But with the Prajnaparamita, it's all swept away. And this is why one must start with it swept away. One must start with dharmas here are empty. One must start there, so that then you're not setting up for yourself traps that already exist, that don't already exist. When you're asking, who am I, you are not trying to find something new. When you're asking, what is mu, you're not looking for that which is mu. You're not looking for that. It is a way by which you confirm the truth that dharmas here are empty. When you're asking, who am I, you are confirming the truth that true self is no self. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is an entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only?
Les quatre vœux.
Tous les êtres innombrables,
je vais me délibérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre tous les êtres innombrables. Je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre tous les êtres innombrables. Je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu